call the House Committee on Health Care to order. We'll do a little organizing business to start, pass our rules. And then my intention is to open up, let me make sure we know what we're doing here, is to open up a public hearing on 4085, take testimony from two House members, and then open up a public hearing on, which one? On 4108, and take some testimony from the sponsors, and then we'll go back into our normal process. That's where we're planning on going now. Do I have a motion on our rules from somebody?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I do. Chair Drinick, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated 2-3-14.
2-3-14. Representative Thompson moves to adopt the committee rules dated 2-3-14. You have them in a packet here. They're the same rules you'll hear in any other committee. I think there are two main changes, as I remember, from the last committee I was in, right? One on when a minority report has to be filed. We have a shorter time frame on filing a minority report, and we also have a shorter time frame on when you need to announce the conflict of interest. Is there anything else, Madam Administrator?
Just to remind everybody, we can do work sessions can be a post and go, so we can post it and gavel in on it on the same day, and those are the highlights.
Okay. We have a motion on the floor to accept the rules. Is there any discussion on that motion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
I will be a no vote on the rules, just to give you a heads up, because of the post and go and the minority report issue. So.
Well, yes, sir. Then let's have a roll call, please.
Representative Klim?
Aye.
Representative Conger?
Excuse.
Representative Parker?
Excuse.
Representative Kinnemer?
Aye.
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Representative Whitener?
No.
Vice Chair Kenny Geyer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Thompson?
Aye.
And Chair Greenlee.
Can we have Representative Parker first?
The rules.
On the rules.
Committee rules.
Representative Parker?
Tempting, but aye.
Yeah. Thank you, and I'm an aye as well. Motion carries, and we have rules. Okay, I'm going to open up the public hearing on House Bill 4085 and ask Representative Williamson, Representative Tomei, to join us and introduce this.
Chair Greenlee and members of the committee. I'm, for the record, I'm Carolyn Tomei, from Representative for House District 41, Milwaukee, Oak Grove, and parts of Southeast Portland. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today about House Bill 4085, which deals with the colonoscopy screening procedures. This measure was brought to our attention by the American Cancer Society to clarify the provisions in the Affordable Care Act surrounding preventative colonoscopy screening. As you know, prevention is a vital part of cost containment and good health. The Affordable Care Act requires insurers to cover preventative care without co-pays and cost sharing. It recommends that people over 50 with no history of colorectal disease to obtain a routine baseline colonoscopy. During that preventative screening process, if the physician finds polyps, these polyps are routinely removed. It is the billing for the polyp removal that needs clarification. Polyp removal is an integral part of a colonoscopy procedure, hence not subject to cost sharing. But sometimes this is not happening, and patients are charged unexpectedly for this cost, the cost of the polyp removal. This bill will clarify that polyp removal is part of the preventative care procedure and not subject to cost sharing. Representative Williamson and her constituent will talk more about her personal experience. And Jason Parks from the American Cancer Society will explain the details of our bill and answer any questions that you may have. And thank you for your consideration on this issue.
Chair Greenlink, members of the committee, my name is Jennifer Williamson. I represent House District 36, the west side of Portland. Thank you for hearing this bill.
Some of the west side.
Some of the west side. West side. I like to say the west side.
Just a hint, don't offend the chair.
I don't know why if the bill didn't go
on. Unhappy in your bill.
Yeah, really. So this issue was first brought to my attention by my constituent, Kathleen Cochran, who you will hear from shortly and hear her personal experience. But she received conflicting information regarding the cost of her colonoscopy, and it's just one example where patients have experienced a frustrating lack of consistency in the billing codes for this procedure. We know that early detection of colon cancer is critical in addressing this very preventable but deadly disease. Without clear coding practices, we risk the possibility that individuals may put off this preventative procedure if they are unsure of the burden of cost sharing. House Bill 4085 will provide patients seeking the necessary and life-saving procedure the assurance that it will be coded as preventative, as the federal guidelines state, and they will not be subject to unanticipated costs. Thank you again for hearing this bill.
Are there any questions? I have one I'd like to put on the table, and it may be for the follow-up witnesses. You talk about an unanticipated charge. In addition to the charge that's possible for snipping those polyps, which is a very routine and simple process in a colonoscopy, any polyps will be sent out for a pathological examination, and that can end up with another very expensive bill. That's not included currently in this.
No, Chair Greenlink, it's not.
It's something we will want to talk about, if not now, in the 2005 session.
Right.
I think it's an important issue. Thank you very much for your
testimony. Thank you for allowing us to testify quickly.
And we'll keep this hearing open and open up a hearing on House Bill 4108 and ask, are you going to testify on this one?
I just let Senator Hansel.
Yeah. I think I'll be saying a few words later, but I'm just delighted to have our across-the-state guests here.
Senator Hansel, will you join us, please? You have a wingman you want to bring with you?
I do.
Actually, I think the easiest way is to move that chair back and... You can go beside us, isn't it?
Yeah. No, I was very impressed with
it. Yeah, it looks like it's working fine. Okay, yeah. Let's go. Good.
That's pretty cool. Thank you, Chair Greenlink and members of the committee. I'm here to testify in favor of House Bill 4108, and I'm also here to testify on the proposed amendments that the chief sponsor has provided, and that would be to add Umatilla County to the test area.
And your name, please, for the record.
I'm sorry, for the record, my name is Bill Hansel, Senator for District 29.
It doesn't include any of the west side of Portland, does it?
That's right. I have no area in the west side of Portland other than France. When we began to hear about what Representative Kenny Geyer wanted to do, it really strung a chord with us, because my friend Darren Umberger, who has come with his son all the way from Pendleton today, left 4 inches of snow to be here to testify. This is exactly what he has been doing for over a decade. Folks that need equipment to repair and to provide, and it's a success story. So I think we have a lot of opportunity to bring to the table from Umatilla County in this case for a statewide trial program. So I'm very supportive of it, and you know, occasionally you'll have someone in your life that is a real inspiration. And I can honestly say that Darren Umbarger has been a tremendous inspiration to me based upon what he has been able to do in helping others in like situations who need equipment in this case and other ways for his volunteer work in our county and throughout Eastern Oregon. So if I may, I'd like to turn over the rest of my time and his time to allow him to share a few thoughts too, please.
Hi, my name is Darren Umbarger. I'm the founder of Clearview Mediation and Disability Resource Center, which is a nonprofit organization in Pendleton, Oregon. When I came across looking at this with Bill, we saw that it was a medical loan closet, which we've been doing for a very long time. And I was doing this where a person would come in and brought a wheelchair in while I was talking to the EOCCO, Eastern Oregon Coordinated Care Organization. I was talking to them at the time, and I said, oh, just put that chair right there. We'll get to it later. Well, he asked what just happened, and I said, well, somebody needed to borrow a wheelchair, so I just loaned it to him. And he goes, do you do that a lot? And I said, yeah, I have a lot of equipment we do that with. And he asked if he funded it, would I make it bigger? Well, what he was talking about funding is he got me a warehouse, and we ended up starting to get the whole community together, and they started donating all this medical equipment. So I have a ton of medical equipment that people come in and they borrow for 1 to 3 months while theirs are getting fixed or they're waiting for one to come in. And so that's what we've been doing for a very long time, but we've just started finding out how much we have saved the taxpayers' money within the last year. So we've figured out just since the last year we've gotten approximately $18,000 in grants, and we've saved the taxpayer $72,000 in rental fees and stuff. Saved the taxpayers that much money so far. So if we can expand this out, we can start doing a whole lot more and make, you know, saving a whole lot more money.
Can I make a correction real quick?
Yes.
Okay. Run up and introduce yourself.
Yes.
There you go. My name is Jeremy Umbarger with
my yes. son.
A quick correction would be that as of this month, we have just went over $100,000 that we've saved. Whoa. So I just wanted to make that real quick.
My kids are always alert to correct me as well.
Yeah, but they don't usually make it better, do they?
Why I sent him to college.
Thank you for your contribution.
Thank you.
Are there any questions? Well, I really appreciate you guys coming with us so far. We have an amendment that we'll talk about when we get into work session that will include Umatilla County with the counties that are named. And we'll increase the financial request from $50,000 to $75,000, and I think we'll be moving. This one goes to Ways and Means, is that
right? It does.
Yeah, we hope we'll get it out of here fast and get it to Ways and Means.
I do have brochures if anybody wants them. I have a bunch of them, so
yeah,
we can get them to the.
Could you distribute to the committee, please?
Thank you very much for accommodating us.
Yes, I'm sorry, Mr. Thompson.
Yeah. I really like this idea because it gives us a real rural aspect to it. This won't be the first time we set something up in Portland and Salem and wondered if it would work in the rest of the state. Mm-hmm. You know, so it'd be a good idea to have that perspective. So test it out there too.
Sounds like it would work a lot easier in Umatilla County.
Sounds like they're way ahead of us.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
Well, I know you probably have to leave, Senator Hansel, but I hope that you're able to stay in here when we get back to this bill.
I think we'll keep going on this one since we're going.
Yeah. Okay.
So I'm going to ask you next.
Okay, great. Well, Well, I mostly want to thank all of the people who have been involved in this bill, starting with my own constituent, David Comegge, who's going to be coming up here. But throughout the process that Representative Thompson and I have co-chaired, the kind of work group to try to wrap our arms around what would a pilot project look like. Is it going to just be seniors or just be children or just be a geographic area? Like, how can we just even take a stab at this? I think we decided the geographic area made sense, and we were trying to include a little bit of rural. To us, that looks rural, Marion and Polk counties. But we heard such incredible things about the work that you've been doing over the last 10 years. And so, yes, rural differences, you know, rural and urban differences are great, and we should consider that right from the start in a pilot project. But selfishly, I guess the whole, you know, we felt that we have so much to learn from you in the rulemaking process, and so we're really delighted to that the bill has continually evolved and changed. I'll say a couple words after the rest of our...
Can I say just one more thing? Is when you talk about pediatrics... the actual ESD has given me all of their pediatric wheelchairs and stuff like that because of the red tape that they have to go through, where it takes somebody, some kid will get into a wheelchair and it's 5 years before he gets another wheelchair. Well, then it starts looking like a whale in a seal skin. He just, right. they don't fit. The VA is actually using me now because it might take 2 to 3 months before they get the paperwork for somebody to have what they need. And so they borrow stuff from us to fill in that time so they get things right away.
It's fantastic.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
We'll call the next three witnesses. And I'd like to ask everybody to be relatively brief. We've got several bills we want to hear today. If somebody else has said something, you don't need to repeat it twice. Once more would be enough.
David Comegge, yeah. Joanne Fulmer, yeah.
Exactly.
And Janet Meyer.
And you want to end it?
Okay.
You want to end it? You want
yeah.
to do the
final? I want to see if anything missing from what they said.
Go for it.
Good afternoon, Chairman Greenlick, Geyer and Thompson, and members of this committee. My name is David Comegge, a physical therapist who received a master's degree with subject focus on pediatrics and developmental impairments. I have worked in hospitals, outpatient settings, school districts, and Oregon Department of Education's regional orthopedic program. Over my career, I've come across many students who are not able to receive durable medical equipment when needed. Children outgrow their equipment, and Medicaid rule does not allow for replacement equipment in a timely manner. I worked with community and hospital-based physical therapists to cobble together safe, medically and functionally appropriate equipment. At Columbia Regional Orthopedic Services, which is part of the regional programs, I manage an equipment bank for students who have severe orthopedic impairments. We serve 400 students' equipment needs in their educational settings by repurposing their equipment. We are responsible for systems to transport, inspect for safety, clean, and modify the equipment. There was a concern about potential litigation from equipment failure. However, we have not had any legal complications. The repurposing equipment model of Columbia Regional Orthopedic Service was successful, and Hospital 4108 would allow piloting of this program with a coordinated care organization. And I work with Darren, a lot of his colleagues in UMass Intermountain.
Thank you.
Okay. Good afternoon. Thank you for hearing me. Chair Gerlich, Vice Chair Geyer, and Thompson. My name is Joanne Furman. I am the representative from the Intellectual and Developmental Disabilities Coalition, and we represent about 30 organizations across the state who work with people with intellectual disabilities. I'm also the Associate Director of Partnerships in Community Living, a private nonprofit that also operates throughout the state supporting people with intellectual and developmental disabilities just to live their life and their communities. The IDD Coalition envisions Oregonians that all people are valued and granted equal opportunity to be treated alike, moving beyond barriers and prejudices. And we have a little bit of our value statement in here, but for time's purpose, I won't read it all to you. Right, so, many Oregonians can't put their lives on hold while they wait for their equipment to arrive or be repaired. Sometimes it takes weeks, even months, for people to get the things they need. Instead, they're accessing already used equipment through informal closets, which you've heard a little bit about, or online or Facebook. And generally, the informal sources don't provide fitting or repair services, and this means people receive used equipment that could put them at risk for injury and other debilitating conditions. Many people have to take that risk, however, because they really have no other choice. So that's just what they do. At PCO, like many other providers, we operate as a closet where we're just collecting equipment as people use it, and many community members donate the equipment to us as well. So we have it available for the people we support, and oftentimes, to be quite honest, their families. Our families of our employees and just different community members call us in need of this sort of equipment. Our equipment closet's really limited, however, because it only contains things that we have that people no longer use or that people have donated to us. There's a few stories I want to share with you that really demonstrate how having another safe market to get this equipment really helped people. And if a project like one in HB 4108 exists, people's lives would be better because they wouldn't have to risk injury or be confined to their home for weeks and months while they wait for new equipment. We support a gentleman, and I could tell you many, but I'll just share this one, who uses a wheelchair. His wheelchair is 15 years old. At times, we've had to use like duct tape to hold it together just so he could get around, and he's been waiting on a new wheelchair for several months. We've had repairs done. We've used fundraising dollars to fix him, but it just doesn't hold up. He really just needs a new chair. But the process takes some time, the approval process and then finding the right fit for him. If we could access a new chair as proposed in HB 4108, he'd have a safe alternative while he's waiting for the approval of his new chair. Even better, he might find one that works for him, and he might not have to order a new chair, which could be a win-win for all of us, because it really saves the system money, and it provides people what they need to live and have full access to their lives. We have people who have not been able to work and go to work because they can't use their equipment or waiting for the new equipment. So this program proposed would allow people access to a much broader range of equipment that would include fitting services. People would not have to rely on equipment that's just not quite right to get their needs met and or to get to their workplace and access communities. Or Oregon can do better for people with disabilities with a durable medical equipment, and the IDD Coalition believes that House Bill 4108 is a step in the right direction. This bill is a win-win because it allows people who are using equipment to get rid, to sort of move it on when they get something else, and other people to repurpose for the next user. So thank you for considering this.
Thank you very much.
Chair Greenwick, Vice Chairs Thompson and Kenny Geyer, and members of the House Committee, HealthShare of Oregon is the largest CCO in the state, serving Multnomah, Clackamas, and Washington counties. My name is Janet Meyer, and I'm the CEO of HealthShare. I've submitted written comments, so I won't read those, but I will say the process of working with David and Representative Kenny Geyer in this, working out some of the details of this proposal has been very inspiring. Very heartwarming to hear of some of the opportunities we have here. Oftentimes, I think the CCOs feel like we're in a position to say no too many times to people who really need our help. This bill gives us a way to say yes. It's an excellent example of how we can take global funding and flexible benefits and improve the outcomes of our clients. So we strongly support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for all the help you've given me. Are there any questions of this panel? Thank you all. Next panel.
Bill Murray, Stacy Bilka, Arena Demetrius.
Is Dean Andretta here?
Huh?
Dean Andretta in the CCO.
They're not signed up.
I just wanted to have all the CCOs go together.
No, that's all right.
That's all I got?
That's all we have.
Okay.
Please remember to introduce yourself.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlake, members of the committee. My name is Bill Murray. I'm the Chief Operating Officer for Family Care, another CCO in Portland, who is pleased to participate in this work group that is bringing forth House Bill 4108. I would echo the comments already made. This is a great opportunity to actually take durable medical equipment, which by definition is not disposable equipment, and be able to reuse, repurpose that equipment in a safe way that extends the benefit to many other individuals and allows our healthcare dollars to go forward. As Canada should do, it's just a great opportunity for us to work together, extend that benefit to many more individuals. I would support this pilot. Our CCO supports this pilot. I think it gives us opportunity to work within a regional area and develop programs that prove support and deliver on the needs of the members that we serve. And I urge your support of this bill going forward. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bill.
Hello, Chair Greenlick, committee members. My name is Stacey Bilka. I am from Norco Medical, a durable medical equipment provider in Portland, Oregon, and we absolutely support this bill and see the need for it as it really bridges the gap in coverage that recipients are finding right now, as with the other presentation. One of the things that I was hoping that committee would take into consideration is how liability will be handled. Most community-based organizations are nonprofit and may not have liability coverage necessary to handle an injury claim. Just one of those claims could put the pilot at risk. So it's just one thing that we see day to day, but you know, could jeopardize the ultimate intention of the pilot. One of the things that can be done to limit liability risk is requiring your participating organizations to be accredited by a federally recognized program, kind of like the Joint Commission. That would lend itself to guidelines for cleaning equipment, storing equipment, patient care, assessments, documentation standards, all which you would want in order for that pilot to really grow and succeed. And I did submit written comments, but I just wanted to address those 2 points. We're very grateful to Representative Geyer to be a part of the work group that she let slide in on the tail end, and look forward to seeing this bill go through.
Thank you very much.
I'm Irina Dimitrescu, also with Norco Medical, and as Stacey mentioned, we've also submitted written testimony, and the verbal one is a co-testimony, so she's already addressed the points.
Thank you
so much.
Any questions of this panel? Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been in cleanup, Representative Kenny Geyer?
Are there any more?
No, nope, that's
no.
It.
I'll just say that this was a great process. It was a very new area for me, but really taking to heart the triple aim goals of trying to increase the quality of healthcare outcomes in the community at in a cost-effective way. It seems like there's a huge gap out there where, as has been mentioned, there's either a rule where, because DME is so expensive, that Oregon Health Authority cannot extend it more than, for instance, a wheelchair every 5 years, and yet kids grow so fast. Or there may be an issue with being able to get appropriate equipment to somebody right away, and then they're stuck in between. There's, you know, if we can provide equipment so that people can continue to work, play, study in their environments in a safe environment, that is the purpose of our healthcare, what we're trying to do in healthcare transformation. And so this bill is not meant to supplant the system we have out there right now, where people are entitled to new equipment periodically, but we're saying we've got equipment out there, and rather than it go to landfills or basements or attics or on a Craigslist where there's no refurbishing and fitting in an appropriate way, how can we create a system so that we can take all that used? So this is incredibly exciting to figure that out. What's the database that draws upon, you know, where are all those different medical closets? How can we exchange oxygen tanks and wheelchairs and hospital beds and things like that? How can we make use of what's out there in a kind of a wonderful but unfortunately a little bit at this point too haphazard system? So that's the attempt of this. I do want to reiterate that it's voluntary. It's voluntary choice that people might choose to give back their equipment to a system. It's voluntary on the part of CCOs, I want to make sure there's not an expectation that because all of a sudden there's a secondary market out there eventually, that CCOs are expected to do it immediately. CCOs are going to have to determine at what point does it make sense for us to pay for transportation, refurbishing, fitting by licensed professionals. Those are the things that the pilot project is trying to attempt. So just wanted to make sure I reiterate that. And then we have some technical amendments in Amendment 1, and we have the expansion to Umatilla, along with increasing from $50,000 request to $75,000 request to accommodate that in the dash 2. So if there are any questions by committee members.
Well, let's close the public hearing and on House Bill 4108 and open up a work session on 4108 for the purpose of adopting some amendments. We don't have the paperwork. This has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, but we don't have the paperwork to move it. But let's get the amendments on the table, and perhaps you could explain. We have a motion on the First Amendment.
Do you want to make a motion?
Somebody.
I move to adopt.
Okay, I move to adopt the First Amendment to House Bill 4108, as presented, dated 1/31/14.
Will somebody explain that amendment to us?
Needs to be the representative.
Thank you. So the main piece of this amendment has to do with Section 2, and the wording that got changed was the pilot project, starting on line 6 here, the pilot project does not supplant the durable medical equipment coverage provided by the Medical Assistance Program. That was just meant to say that we're trying to create a secondary program. If there were any concerns about what are we doing to what the eligibility is now that people can access, that's not the purpose of this pilot program. So that was the main thing. There were we added on the second piece of it, acting in accordance with quality standards adopted by the authority. We wanted to make sure that in the rulemaking process, the authority, the Oregon Health Authority, looks at what are the quality standards or certain Medicare and other kinds of quality standards at the federal level, and so all of that will be a part of the framework that they will look at. How do you determine that? We got input from vendors, both Norco, so thank you for testifying today, as well as New Motion, and they've been in this business for a long time and have legitimate concerns about liability, and so we wanted to make sure that the liability language was in there. So again, that becomes a part of the rulemaking process. The authority shall develop, collect data, include feedback from coordinated care organizations, consumers, and healthcare providers, and analyze the data. This was really, again, to make sure that as we design the components of the pilot project, we have a feedback mechanism for CCOs and consumers to talk about, because it's a pilot. How do we improve it? So to make sure that there's kind of a consumer voice in there, but also that CCOs have a voice in working with the authority. And I just realized that Don Ross, head of DMAP at Oregon Health Authority, is here. If people do have questions about any of this, I wanted one more kind of clarification. My interpretation in the bill of the October, the pilot will be ready to be implemented, is that the Oregon Health Authority would have its rulemaking done by October, not that we would expect the RFP to have gone out and have come back, and a pilot is already in process. So if there's any kind of for any of you in the audience, if the language doesn't look like it reflects that, please let me know, because we'd want to come back on Wednesday with that.
All right. We have a motion on the floor to adopt the dash one amendments dated 1/31/14. Is there any further discussion on the amendments? On that amendment? Is there any objection to that amendment? So moved. Have another motion passed. The amendment's in. We have a dash 2 amendment.
Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the dash 2 amendments to House Bill 4108, dated 1/30/14.
Representative Thompson moves the dash 2 amendments to House Bill 4108, dated 1/30/14. That has a function of adding Umatilla County and moving the $50,000 to $75,000 for the. Is there any discussion on that amendment? Is there any objection to that amendment?
I feel kind of pressured over here.
You better behave yourself. That motion carries, and we'll close the work session on House Bill 4108 and be back on Wednesday. And if you're right, if there's any clarification we need, let's do it rather quickly because we'll need to get the paper in to get it over to Ways and Means. We continue to be open on the public hearing on House Bill 4085. Mm-hmm. And how many?
Three people.
Three people. Would you please call the panel?
Absolutely. Looking for Kathleen Cochran, Jason Parks, and John C. Powell.
Can't waste any time, man. Short session. I
recommend Debbie. Please remember to introduce yourself.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify in favor of House Bill 4085. My name is Kathleen Cochran. I'm a citizen. I'm a constituent of Representative Williamson, who has control over the entire West Side.
He thinks.
He's a freshman anyway.
1,540. This is the estimated number of new colon cancer cases estimated for the state of Oregon this year. House Bill 4085 can save lives. As the second leading cause of cancer death, colon cancer is formidable, whichever you prefer. But the one thing that distinguishes colon cancer, perhaps from some other cancers, is a screening tool exists. It's readily available, and it makes colon cancer nearly preventable. So why aren't more Oregonians over the age of 50 electing to have this procedure? Beside the obvious fear of the procedure itself, there is a significant barrier with cost and confusion about coverage. An average cost of a colonoscopy in the Portland area is around $2,000, and it could be more if an anesthesiologist administers the sedation, and depending on the facility. 70% of respondents to a 2012 survey said coverage confusion would deter them from having a colonoscopy. Cost barrier is precisely what this bill seeks to remedy, to align Oregon law with federal law clarification that cost sharing cannot be imposed for a screening colonoscopy where a polyp is detected. I became aware of the cost sharing issue when I got ready to have my own first screening colonoscopy, and I started reading about blogs online of Oregonians that were being billed for this procedure when a polyp was detected. So I decided to conduct a sort of secret shopper among some providers in the Portland area. I contacted five, and I told them I was getting ready to schedule my first colonoscopy, and I asked them how they would code the procedure if they found a polyp. All five said they would code it as diagnostic, which means they would impose cost sharing. Then I contacted my insurance company, and I said, you know, I'm about to go in for my first colonoscopy. You know, if they detect a polyp, how would it be covered under my health care plan? Sadly, four customer service representatives that I spoke with, they were evasive. I could not get a straight answer. The most I walked away with was that they take their cue from how providers code the procedure. But even when I provided them the codes, they wouldn't tell me how they would process the claim. So I went into my first colonoscopy uncertain as to whether I was going to get billed. The intent of the federal law was to remove barriers to these life-saving procedures, not just colonoscopies, but mammograms and prostate exams and so on. But confusion over coverage is preventing people from having these procedures. House Bill 4085 is intended to clear up this confusion, and it should increase the number of people that have these procedures and the lives that are saved. I want to commend the American Cancer Society for introducing the bill. This is an opportunity for Oregon to serve as a national model on this important healthcare issue. 1,540 new colon cancer cases in Oregon this year alone. This is a cancer we can make progress on. I urge you to vote in favor of House Bill 4085. Thank you for letting me speak.
Thank you.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jason Parks. I'm the Government Relations Director for the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network here in Oregon. And I'm here to testify in favor of House Bill 4085. I believe you have my written testimony in front of you, so I won't bother rehashing that. I'll just restate that the intention of this bill is to clarify that for asymptomatic individuals on non-grandfathered plans between the ages of 50 to 75, the colonoscopy up through the removal of the polyps will be covered with no cost sharing. That's our intention. And Chair Green, like I know you're interested in extending the coverage to the labs themselves, and that's something we'd be interested in doing as well. In the future, but as far as this bill goes, this unfortunately won't cover that. But in the future, we'd be more than happy to work with you. So be happy to answer any questions.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is John C. Powell, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon in support of House Bill 4085. The language in 4085 represents our current policy, and we, in fact, go further than that and cover related lab tests, anesthesiology, and things like that right now. So we would also be supportive of what you have discussed, Chair Greenlick. And with that, I won't waste any more of your time.
You're a lot more cooperative than the other guy that used to
Thank you.
It
looks like him, doesn't it?
Better looking, I'd say.
More hair.
Are there any, questions for this panel?
I have a question. Would any of you be opposed to an amendment that would include the laboratory fees?
Not at all.
As long as we can still get it passed, that would be great. yeah, that would be ideal for our perspective to get that passed. But you know, we feel pretty good about the bill that we have right now, so we kind of want to keep as is. But if there was a way to get it through, yeah, we would be all for that.
I want to make sure we don't create any new opposition.
Right. There you go.
Well, I want to also just commend Regents on covering all of those voluntarily.
Yeah, the other thing that I discovered in researching this, the main problem is when a provider, as mentioned earlier, doesn't know to code it as a preventive procedure instead of a diagnostic. That's where the issues are likely coming up. So anything that can be done to help. We're trying to educate our provider network, and I've spent a lot of time doing it, and we're continuing to do it.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4085. We don't have the paperwork, and I'm going to get it till Wednesday, so we will not move into a work session. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 4013. Do we have any public, anybody signed up for 4013?
Debbie's checking for us now, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, just to remind you, House Bill 4013 authorizes practitioners to electronically transmit prescriptions for Schedule II controlled substances in non-emergency situations. This has an emergency clause effective on passage. We had a briefing on this concept during the interim, so a lot of it should just be a refresher course for the committee members, Mr. Chair.
And this is kind of a cleanup of a bill trying to get the state statutes consistent with federal statutes.
Correct. Well, and I just wanted to remind everybody or let the committee know we do have a fiscal and a revenue on this bill, minimal expenditure impact and no revenue should the committee choose to take action. Rob Bovet, Ken Wells, and Nikki Tirziev. Please. Oh, okay. Then do we want to move into Jeremy?
Rob, in fact, is the one that brought this bill to us in the first place and strongly supports it.
Chair Greenlink, members of the committee, my name is Ken Wells. I'm representing the Board of Pharmacy. I'm a pharmacist member on the board. And as you stated, yes, this does clean up and get the federal legislation and state the same. So I know that Chair Greenlink and Vice Chair Thompson are sponsored this, and we greatly appreciate that. And we just ask for the support of the committee.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, always a pleasure to be in front of you. Nikki Terzieff on behalf of the Oregon State Pharmacy Coalition. We represent both community-based and health system-based pharmacists and pharmacies. As noted previously in our conversation on this is a bill we think is good for patient safety, patient convenience. It's good for public safety, and it will, of course, then codify what was existing practice for our pharmacists.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, Jeremy Vandy with Kaiser Permanente. Kaiser is here in support of the bill today. This, as already mentioned, this will align state law with federal law. It also will align Oregon statute with Washington statute. Washington passed similar legislation last year. So for Kaiser Permanente, which is on both sides of the river, it's always helpful when practices are aligned, and would echo a sentiment that we believe it would ultimately improve safety, allow tracking of adverse events and drug-seeking behavior. The other thing I just would mention is this really just allows for the application for a physician and a provider to get approval from the DEA to be able to do electronic prescribing. So there's still provisions in federal law that you still have to jump through in order to get the certification. This just allows the provider to go forward and seek that certification.
I was at a Kaiser facility last week, and the doctor prescribed a prescription, and we went out, we were in the car, we got a phone call in the car. Oh, you have to have a paper copy of that prescription. If you come to the door of the facility, my nurse assistant will be down there to give you the paper copy. And I said, I'm going to change this. Well, thank you very much if we have no questions. Close the public hearing on House Bill 4013 and open a work session on House Bill 4013. Do we have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move we House Bill 4013 move to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Thompson moves House Bill 4013 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Would you call the roll, please?
Representative
Clem? Aye.
Representative
Conger? Aye. Representative Parker? Aye. Representative Kenner?
Aye.
Representative Wagner?
Aye.
Excused.
Vice Chair Kenny Geyer?
Aye. Vice Chair Thompson? Aye. And Chair Greenlee?
Aye. Motion
carries.
Representative Thompson, would you like to carry it?
I would. Thank you.
Representative Thompson will be the carrier. Close the work session on House Bill 4013. Open up a public hearing on House Bill 4050. Representative Harkin, would you like to kick this off?
Sure, just briefly. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill is intended to deal with the consequence of House Bill 2240, which we passed last year. We passed in order to bring our state insurance code into line with the Federal Affordable Care Act. One component of the bill expanded the definition of a small group from 1 through 50 up to 1 through 100, beginning in January of 2016. The number of Oregon businesses that have between 51 and 100 employees are currently self-insured, and many have been so for a decade or two. Unless we change the law, these companies will be forced to get rid of their health insurance that is working well for them. We have a panel that will speak in detail about the consequences of it. Some of you were here in January for committee days and heard about it at that time. I was not quite so lucky, and I missed out on it. But I think the panel will...
Poor baby.
Yeah. I'm not complaining. I'm not whining. Just stating.
Very whiny.
All right.
In Australia, instead of being here, I don't know.
It was a rough spot in Australia. Yeah. The heat was terrible. Just brutal. So all we're trying to do is address that, and we've got businesses around the state. I visited one in my district, and many of them are going to be negatively impacted by this unless we are able to make this change. So it goes fairly straightforward. And
we have a panel.
We do.
Jake Gibbs, Doug Barber, Angela Dixon, and then after those individuals, we'll have Tom Apperson on deck.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, Doug Barber here today on behalf of the Oregon Association of Health Underwriters. I testified in January before you to give a background on the bill. Representative Harker, again, summarized it, so I'm not going to take more time to do that. I'll turn my time over to Tom Apperson and let the business owners describe why this is so important to them and be happy to answer questions at the end.
One sentence, will you please? You just give your perception, a one-sentence statement about what this bill is about.
I'm sorry, say?
Would you just give a one-sentence statement about what this bill is about?
This bill preserves the right for businesses with more than 51 covered lives to self-insure.
By allowing them to buy?
To buy reinsurance.
Without the ability to buy reinsurance, it would be...
It's too risky for them to self-insure.
Right.
So what the bill says is that businesses with 50 or fewer covered lives would be prohibited from buying reinsurance.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair.
You don't have to leave. There may be...
Oh, he was going to run.
Oh, okay. Good.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. My name is Jake Gibbs. I am with Lone Rock Timber out of Roseburg, Oregon. I'm here representing my 92 fellow co-workers and the 184 family members that our current health insurance practice, our coverage provides for. Lone Rock is family-owned. We were founded in 1950. We're under third-generation management, have been self-insured and using reinsurance for over 20 years. We range in age of employees from probably 18, 19 years old to 66 years old. I've been with the company for over 17 years and represent a good kind of median representation of the company. Some background. Another point of interest, I guess, is that Lone Rock was named number 27 in Business Magazine's top 100 businesses last year, which is voted on by the employees. So I think that's a good representation of our support for the current management practices provided. While we're family-owned, the company employees, we view our company as ours. It's not theirs. It's ours, and the family fully supports that. High-quality work is rewarded via safety program rewards. We have an incentive pay program, high-quality health care that we enjoy, the family profit shares, and contributes regularly to our retirement programs. We're all... highlight for me in that is that 2009 was a record recession year in the timber products industry, and it was definitely a mantra that no one was let go. We maintained 100% of our staff, and that was because of the benefits of having an insurance program like this to maintain those costs. We had the flexibility when those dollars were saved, they were banked, and this is how they were used. So I'm proud to say that we have all of our past employees that were there in 2009 are still with us. Benefits of self-insurance, lower costs with high value for the employees, better insight into how we use our benefit package. We're able to tailor that and actually educate ourselves. I think I know what my benefit package provides me, and lo and behold, I don't. So I'm able to get feedback through this program and learn how to be a better shopper and a better healthy person. And we routinely, the savings have been utilized, like I said, through bonuses. The money's come back to the company. We utilize those to maintain our workforce. So I'll end there. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hello, I'm Angela Dixon with Automotive Industrial Marketing Corporation. Thank you for listening to me today. AIMCO has been self-insured since 1996. Since 1999, we've been with the same broker, so I pulled those numbers, and we've saved nearly $600,000 being self-insured. We have a robust benefit program as well. We offer Eastern medicine as well as Western medicine. For those of you who maybe don't know, chiropractic visits cost a lot less than a visit to the doctor's office for traditional Western medicine. Our prescriptions are lower because that's an option. Our employees have let us know what they're interested in, and that's what we try to provide for them. One of the other unique things that we've done is we have employees almost you know, virtually no turnover, right? So people are working there 13, 14 years. So now they have college-age students, and they go away to school. And one of the things that we did was we made it so that we have networks for those college students so they don't have these $500 deductibles. They can still go to the doctor for $20. So it's great. It's been mutually beneficial. They have in-network benefits even though they're away. We have been able to track, as you said, the cost of things and what really matters to our employees and what they're utilizing because we're self-insured and we can get those numbers. We started out being self-insured because we had a 22% rate hike for no discernible reason. So we didn't have anyone who was sick. We didn't have anyone that had died. But it was low cost 1 year, and then the next year just got hit. So I've been with the company 16 and a half years. I, too, am sort of middle of the road. What we've done is offer benefits as well. We've raised our premiums once in 10 years for our employees. And our deductible we've raised once in 10 years. So while things have been rough the last 10 years for a lot of companies, this is a major benefit that we've been able to offer our employees. And we're able to answer their questions, any kind of unique coverage that they need. We had flexible choices. We had a leukemia patient who we were able to have a laser on his coverage. So when we went up for reinsurance for our new year, we were able to set a higher amount that we would pay for that one person rather than everybody's rates being increased. And as it so happens, sadly, he passed away 23 days into the new year, but we didn't pay higher rates for the whole year as we would have with a fully insured program. So again, I think this has been vital in keeping our company healthy. We've used that money to help make sure we're covering the things that employees need, but also offer incentives. I can't think of the last time someone voluntarily left. Besides moving, it's been years. So we're a happy, healthy company, and we'd like to keep it that way.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm Tom Apperson. I'm with Stagecraft Industries in Portland, North Portland on Swan Island. On Saturday, my company celebrated its 54th year in existence as an Oregon employer. The average length of employment for our current workforce is 15 and a half years. We've been partially self-funded in excess of 20 years. I can tell you the primary reason we looked at it to begin with was the lack of transparency that we found in the fully insured market. We had no idea where the money was going. Premiums were up and down like a yo-yo. Everybody wanted to buy the business the first year and then give you the big increase year two. Self-funding has changed that dramatically for us. So that's why we were receptive to it. Same experience, long-time company, good employees. We share our profits. We've got a great 401k. We've saved money with our medical insurance because of partial self-funding, and we use that money to keep the deductibles low. We've got a great plan. We've got a great network. I've been told by our broker that our plan is very rich for a private employer, and we'd like to keep it that way. We like our employees. We like being here in Oregon. It's a great thing. Flexibility is the other thing we find to be a wonderful function of partially self-funding. For example, come renewal, I can do all kinds of what ifs. What if we do this? What if we do that? What if we raise the deductible but lower the copay? What are the options? And we can get those answers. One last thing. A few years back, we had a claim that was initially denied by the carrier because it was something that was not part of our plan at that point in time. That claim was coming out of our pocket, so we went ahead and paid it anyway, and our next renewal, we covered that procedure. That's the kind of thing you can do as an employer for your people.
And as a result of the change in statute, all three of your companies were denied the ability to get reinsurance to go over the top of your...
Will be.
Will.
That's right. Going into effect, yeah.
Yeah. Would be. Yes.
Correct.
Right. Other questions in this panel? Yes, ma'am.
Well, first of all, thank you very much. And Angela, thank you for the great tour I had at Automotive. And I just wanted to say that one of the reasons that I'm very supportive of this is for one of the reasons that Representative Conger is so passionate about in terms of personal engagement, because you talked about how, because you all are bottom line going to pay the health care bills, yep. So you're putting yourself basically at risk, that you have really, you know, reached out to make sure that people have good nutrition and opportunities for exercise and stress reduction and all those kind of things. So I thought that was a really interesting piece of this. I just wanted to ask you whether you know, it's 50 covered lives, I don't think 50 employees. Is there, have you heard of any kind of case in which going to a certain level is, there's been any kind of problem? At the time I talked to you last, I don't think there were, it was any company that had gone under because, you know, they ended up having some astronomical health care expense came in. But can you talk at all about that piece of it? The covered lives versus employees, and, you know, what we want to make sure that none of the questions come up with regard to that.
Well, what's terrific is with the individual stop loss, and you can address this too, is that you know what your budget is for the next year in all areas, and when you're fully insured, it's always kind of, ooh, it's going to happen, right? But this is, you can set your tolerance level, and that's the great thing. Is so if it's $50,000 or $70,000, that you're like, okay, if we had three people hit that mark, we'd still be okay, we'd still be saving compared to fully insured, it's an absolute no-brainer. It just doesn't make any sense to not make that available to people. So it's quite the opposite. I found that there's no trouble.
Representative Kenny Geyer, the...
Reintroduce yourself again, Doug.
Oh, I'm sorry, Doug Barber again. The issue about covered life versus FTE, under the current law, because the prohibition on reinsurance is linked to the definition of small employer, it has to be FTE. It's it is 50 FTE or fewer. But since we're in the bill, delinking from the definition of small employer. Let me back up a second. Under the current law, you could have an employer with 51 employees that does not cover dependents, and they would be able to self-insure. You could have another business with 49 employees that does cover dependents, has 120 in their group, and they're too small. It just doesn't make sense if we're... It does be under the definition of small group because of the FTE requirement. But if we're delinking from the definition of small group, it doesn't make any sense logically to say 51 is big enough but 120 is too small. So what makes more sense is to go with the size of the group, which is the number of covered lives. And that's why the bill is written as 50 or fewer covered lives.
I don't understand what you just said.
The current law...
You've managed to confuse us.
The current law says...
We're talking about between 50 and 100, is that
right? But the current law is all linked to the definition of small group.
Yes.
And the expansion of the definition of small group, which is all based on FTE.
Up to 100.
Between 51 and 100. So,
I'm a classic example. If this law doesn't change, my group will no longer qualify because I am right now today at 50 employees. Unfortunately, the economy is taking a toll on us. We expect to come back. I don't want to lose this. This has been a great benefit for us. If it's covered lives, we pay 90% for the employee. We pay 70% for their dependents. My covered lives is well beyond 50, and now I'm back in the game, and that's where I want to be.
But this bill will not only... I mean, this bill doesn't only say go back to the way it used to be. It does something else. Is that right?
This bill says that if your group has more than 50 covered lives, not more than 50 FTE.
So this could be 20 employees.
It could be 20 or 25 employees. If you cover dependents and had a group of 75, 65, then you would be, you could self-insure.
So
if the group is large,
you're doing more than reconnecting to the way it used to be.
Right.
In this bill.
Because since we're delinking from the definition of self-insurance, that to say that a group of 51 employees is big enough, but 49 employees that covers 120 people is too small, just didn't make any sense. Which is what the current law says.
Small group.
No, I understand.
That, you know, and that, and you know, under the current law, you can't get around that because of the link, because it's linked to that small group definition.
Well, why don't you just take away the restriction to buy reinsurance for anybody then?
I mean, you
have a relatively small group in this case.
There, I don't have personally. I don't have a problem with that. And in fact, we met with one of the businesses we met with. It's a company called Plexus Healthcare down in Ashland. Senator Bates and Representative Buckley met with them. They're self-insured. I think they have about 70 or 80 employees, but they're a software development company, and they write software for third-party administrators who administer self-funded plans all over the country, many of whom are 10 to 20 employees. And have been self-insured very successfully for years, is what they reported. Now, there's no groups that size in Oregon because they're too small. The prohibition on reinsurance, I met with the insurance division about it. They said that prohibition went into effect in 1967. Back then, we defined small group as 2 to 25. So the rationale, they said, was that, you know, small groups lack the sophistication to make the judgment about whether that was an acceptable risk. But they, you know, again, it was a group of 2 to 25. Then in 2000, I believe it was, if I remember correctly, 2009, when Oregon changed the definition of small group from 2 to 25 to 2 to 50. And this issue never came up then. But I'm told subsequently that there were some businesses that were caught in that, businesses between 25 and 50 employees that had been self-insured that were forced to give that up. I didn't hear about it at the time, but as I was working on this bill, I did.
Could we hear from the insurance division?
Can I ask one question for clarification?
Yeah.
So forgetting what's going to happen in the future in ACA and how you're trying to prevent that problem between 50 and 100, right now our current law says that you cannot have self-insurance if you're 50 FTE or under? Is
reinsurance.
Self-insurance.
Correct.
Not self-insurance. This isn't about self-insurance. I mean, the prohibition is not on self-insurance. The prohibition is on the ability to buy reinsurance.
On the stop-loss coverage.
Which is needed in order to do self-insurance. Okay. You can do self-insurance without reinsurance, right?
Not really.
I was told that Paul Allen's company, for example, is self-insured.
Uh-huh.
Without reinsurance. You know, you
but
could take
you,
the risk.
Does our current law prohibit you from having your own reinsurance, self-insurance policy right now?
I think I could be fully self-insured under current law. I would never do it. The risks are just too great. One catastrophic claim and you close your doors. You know, the whole purpose is to make the day-to-day claims manageable and have visibility, mm-hmm. design your plan around the needs of your employees, educate them that emergency room is not a primary care physician. Little things that you can do that greatly bring down your day-to-day medical insurance mm-hmm. costs.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
He's here. Anthony, you want to?
But I feel like this is to help us in committing here.
Can you come and help us?
Yeah.
I knew I asked you to be along here just in case we needed some questions.
Sure, no problem. My name is Anthony Behrens. I'm a senior policy analyst with the Insurance Division of the State of Oregon Department of Consumer and Business Services. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Why are we limiting who can do reinsurance? What's the underlying philosophy? I mean, I'm really tempted in this case to simply change the statutes to not prohibit reinsurance for anybody. What underlies this?
So I'll preface my comments by saying that the department has not taken a position on the bill at this time. But our understanding of basically the sort of the reasons this statute came into effect. And Mr. Barber said 1963, but I believe the statute's either 1993 or 1995, so not too long ago. So it may have coincided with that small group change. But the purpose of the limitation on reinsurance is essentially when you have the smaller the risk pool, the more volatility you'll typically see in claims, and you may, so as I understand the bill written, you might have an employer that has 10 employees and maybe they have 41 dependents, so they're a very small employer and they may not have the sort of revenue or ability to adjust for a, you know, even one or two small, large medical claims. And that's sort of my understanding is that they wanted, when the bill...
Reinsurance is to deal with those large medical claims, right?
Yeah, but even when you're, excuse me, Representative Greenlink, members of the committee, when you're talking about that those kind of micro, really small employers, even a claim of $10,000 or $15,000 can be a big hit. And I guess maybe one of the concerns of that sort of limiting the number at which you could sell reinsurance or having a high, you know, relatively high number of 50 was also to, I guess, protect employees in case the insurer or the employer couldn't handle those costs, because then if that's the case, the employee is essentially left without coverage.
This bill would allow a small group, let's say Representative Harker's old company with 15 employees, which maybe would have 36 family members, would be 51 and would be covered under, and would be allowed under this, right? I mean, that's not what I thought was happening before.
Because of the difference between FTEs and covered lives?
Yeah. Representative Conger, you had a comment on that?
Well, I just, it kind of a, maybe more of a question. It seems to me that the risk that you're talking about is, first of all, your comment, Mr. Chair, you know, the whole point is to allow smaller companies to buy the reinsurance to take the risk of the catastrophic health care issue, the catastrophic cost, and push it off into a bigger pool. That's what reinsurance is for. And so what I don't understand, you know, to go back to the original question, is why is there a problem with having a smaller, even smaller than we're talking about here, smaller group of employees? If the employer wants to self-insure, they're going to have to go to the reinsurance company, who's going to look at that small group and evaluate the risk, because that's the business that they're in, and they're going to charge the small company accordingly. What do we care from a policy perspective how they work that out? And so you're talking about risk, not fraud, and fraud obviously is a different issue, right? Somebody's saying that they're insured and they're not. So just talking about the risk, I don't even understand what the point is. It seems to me that, back to the original question, you could have smaller groups, and the insurer, between the employer and the insurer, would work out whether or not that was realistic from a cost perspective.
This is sort of protecting small groups from themselves, I assume, is what we're saying.
Well, but why?
I don't understand.
Market as opposed to
regulatory. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, I don't see why to say to them, we're not going to let you reinsure because that would encourage you to self-insure.
What level do you take?
Great.
So what?
Right.
And either you decide you could afford that or not.
Exactly.
All right, I'm going to No, go ahead.
Okay, thank you. Representative Greenlee and Representative Conger to, I guess, address your statement. So right now the bill has limits on the attachment point. So an insurer can't insure us if the bill was left as it is. An insurer couldn't issue reinsurance with an attachment point below $10,000. That means that the employer has to pay up to $10,000, and also it contains a cap on the other end. And I'm looking to see if that's an and. So, and then on the top end, the claims don't kick in until 120%. I guess I have kind of an example.
An example might be good because I'm not tracking
okay,
with you.
Sure,
I don't know
sure.
what an attachment point is, and I don't know what 120% of what is.
Okay, sure. So basically what this means is that the employer will pay up to 10,000 claims per covered individual. And
at
that point,
$10,000
in claims.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
At that point, the insurer will assume liability. Aggregate or the top attachment point that I was talking about establishes that the minimum attachment point of 120% of expected claims. So if you had claims of $1,000 per family per month and there are 90 employees, then your annual expected claims are $1,080,000. So 90 employees times 1,000 times 12 months. So at the top end, that aggregate amount, that 120% of claims, would not kick in until the claims reached $1,296,000. So roughly a difference of $200,000 based on that example. So at the top end, the insurer only begins to cover when it hits 120%. I just want to verify that it's so. My understanding is the way that reinsurance typically works is that you'll have both you can use a top end attachment point and a low end attachment point together. This bill says that if you use just the individual attachment point of $10,000. So you can either choose the individual of $10,000 or the aggregate of 120%. So it would be up to the employer which one of those they choose. But it's going to be at least $10,000 per claim or 120% of the claims the insurer will pay after they reach that 120% mark.
I'm going to close the public hearing. Thank you for, I think, explaining something.
That didn't answer the question, Mr.
No,
Chair.
I think we need to get this offline, so I'm going to hold a work session on this until we've individually had a chance to figure out what's going on. Mr. Barber, you've got some work to do on this one. Okay. Close the public hearing. And open a public hearing on House Bill 4109. Will you describe this thing to us, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you may recall this was a committee bill that we've had a briefing on a couple of times. This bill requires that the Oregon Health Authority commission an independent study on the costs and impacts of operating and implementing the basic health program in Oregon, specifies the parameters of the study and requires that a report be submitted to the Legislative Assembly by November 30th, 2014. This does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, Mr. Chair. If the committee so chooses, we do have a fiscal and a revenue statement if the committee chooses to take action.
Is there a fiscal light that goes to Ways and Means?
Actually, it is a fiscal statement per se. It says, according to the estimate received, the contract fees needed by OHA for a study could range from $55,000 to $60,000. So they have an estimate fiscal statement.
Do we have any signed up for public?
We do, Mr. Chair. We have John Mullen and Doug Barber. But let me check with Doug and see if that could be in.
Probably got on the wrong page.
Yeah.
Mullen, go for it.
Now what are we doing? Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. I'm not going to go into any great detail about this discussion because you've all been briefed about basic health and the provision of the ACA that allows states to have this option. This bill before you, House Bill 4109, is simply a study bill. Our group, the Inclusiveness, Affordability, Innovation Coalition, doesn't have any preconceived notion that this is going to be the right tool for Oregon. But because we're so very concerned about affordability and also for those people who are legally present residents that are barred from Medicaid for 5 years, we think it's in the best interest of Oregon and Oregonians to set aside a modest amount of money for a study so that we can all have a chance to look at what it would mean for the state of Oregon. You'll see in my testimony that we have a discussion with numerous groups and individuals. In addition, you'll see that SEIU has submitted testimony. We emphasize the fact that this bill is a study bill, and we hope that the committee will act on it, send it to Ways and Means, and hopefully if it's enacted, we will have a really very good public process to make sure that all stakeholders that are interested are included in the discussion about how it will be scoped and how it will be implemented, the study itself. Thank you.
Does anybody from OHA want to comment on this? Well,
he's like, no, but I'll come up with it.
Representative Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, Courtney Westling, Director of Legislative Affairs for the Oregon Health Authority. John's been in touch with us regularly. You have our fiscal. I think, you know, this makes sense for now.
You have no problem with it, assuming you get the money.
Right.
Thank you. Barber? Hello.
Doug Barber, here on behalf of the Oregon Association of Health Underwriters. There's just one issue I'd like to put on the record about the basic health plan. I've had a chance to talk with John about this briefly, and that has to do with choice. As I understand the way the basic health plan works, if Oregon were to approve and implement a basic health plan, all of the people but with incomes between 138 and 200% of federal poverty would be required to go into the basic health plan. They would not have a choice about whether they do that or select a plan through the exchange. And what we saw, and the reason that I think that that's significant, is when the FEOP plan was operational, the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, there was a population of children whose families had a choice. They could either receive Oregon Health Plan for free, or the parents could pay to purchase private insurance, subsidized private insurance for their children. And my assumption was, well, families will take the free OHP plan. It's better benefits and it's free. It's not what happened. A number of parents chose to pay. And I had a number of conversations with Rocky King, who at the time was running that program, and he said they didn't do any detailed analysis about why that was, but his speculation was that it was some combination of stigma, access, provider panel, parents wanted their kids on the same plan that they were on, they thought their kids were treated or they were treated differently in the doctor's office when they had a private insurance card versus an OHP card. For whatever reason, these low-income parents chose to pay premiums for their children rather than get free Oregon Health Plan.
And that, you know, that stuck with me for years. I mean, I think because I was so surprised by it. And then there was, as this fall, as the, you know, as Cover Oregon rolled out, there was a story in the Oregonian business section, and I sent it to Debbie. It's probably not in Olish yet, but it will be. It was in the Sunday business section in the, it's called It's Our Money column. And the columnist had gotten letters from four constituents, all of whom were low-income adults who had inputted their information into the system. They'd all qualified for Medicaid, but they didn't want it. They all wanted subsidies to buy private insurance. And we're trying to figure out, well, so how do I do that?
Which they couldn't get.
They had no choice. They, you know, it's like, and I've since heard from, you know, I raised it at a meeting with some insurance brokers, and they said some of them have had people come into their offices who have been in that position where they've submitted their information, they've been told you qualify for the Oregon Health Plan, and they've gone in to see a broker and said, well, I don't want it, what can I do? And so I just think it's an issue that as we study a basic health plan, we want to make sure that we keep in mind that that there are at least some people out there for whom choice is very important.
And that should be a topic of the study, is what you're saying.
Yes.
You also represent the Oregon Primary Care Association?
I do not represent the Primary Care Association, okay. No. That's Doug Riggs.
That's Doug.
What's
Doug? No, it's not Doug anymore.
Oh. It was Doug Riggs.
Jonathan Eames.
Who is it? Oh, John, that's right. I saw John.
My aunt.
Do they have a position on this, John? We'll find out.
Okay, somebody's going to have to move.
Thank you, Courtney.
Thank you.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, Angie Dulks with the Oregon Primary Care Association. We support the study.
Good. Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. We close the public hearing.
Thank you.
And open a work session on House Bill 4109 for the purpose of sending the bill off to the Ways and Means Committee, where it will be. Do we have a motion on this one?
Let's see in front of that. Is that dumb?
Do you need
Mr.
Scripted?
Chair, I move that we move House Bill 4109 with a subsequent referral to
do pass,
as a do pass.
With a do pass recommendation.
With a referral.
With a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
With a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Representative Kenny Geyer moves that we pass House Bill 4109 with a do pass recommendation, and that it subsequently be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
By prior reference,
right. Is there a discussion on this? There's discussion on even taking it as a committee bill. Mr. Conyer?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I just, I think a couple of comments. One, the idea here is to create a restrictive program that forces consumers into an even more narrow band of health insurance options from, as I understand it, 138% of poverty level, federal poverty level, through 200% of poverty level.
It's 0% through 200 for people who are not qualified for Medicaid because they're...
Including legal residents who are not citizens.
For 5 years. They're
thank
all
you.
Away, but other people are.
Right. For citizens, it'd be 138% to 200%. For legal resident non-citizens, it would be 0 to 200%. And then to subsidize, as I understand it, again, a basic health plan creates a subsidy for purposes of driving their premiums down that they pay. It strikes me that, you know, a couple of things. the insurance market, health insurance, the health insurance market, healthcare in general is in an absolute state of transition, and I would even say disarray. You know, I don't want to oversell it, but it strikes me that it's moving so quickly and it's changing so rapidly that it's very difficult for employers, for consumers, for insurers, for providers to keep up with what's going on as a result of the changing legal environment. I think it's a bad idea to continue to pile on. I know it's just a study, but it's a study of something, you know, it's kind of a solution looking for a problem, in my opinion. It's not a huge amount of money, but it's still money that we could be spending in other areas. And I am completely unconvinced that the basic health plan is something that is actually beneficial in the long run. We're talking about self-insurance and what people can do when they're working on and when they're invested in their health. And I think those kinds of things are exciting and have real possibilities for, in the long run, bending the health, the cost curve. This, to me, is just sort of piling on more stuff. And so, I'll be a no.
Representative Klein, did I?
The reason I'm sort of interested in where we go from here on this, I think Washington is doing it, if I remember right, already, and so we're looking to learn a little bit from them, I think. And the thing that particularly is interesting to me, it's that group who is getting some subsidies, certainly, under the new program, but still paying like $400 a month. And that's quite a lot. If you only make $20,000, $22,000, I mean, it's quite a lot. And I think we were hoping that with the subsidies, that would be, you know, 50. And so what I'm, you know, interested to see, I think, from the study is how can you align a plan that essentially gets it down to zero or, you know, $50 a month or something reasonable. And how is it that we're able to, if it's working in the state of Washington, how are they able to do it when what we're finding is $300 and $400 premiums and maybe not even, you know, I don't know if it's the same benefit package or this ends up being lower, and that's, but it's that group right in there that I'm most worried about. Working poor, making $25,000 for a family of two and still coming up with $400 a month off the exchange. Maybe this isn't it. I don't know. And, you know, I think Doug brought up a good point, which is there a way legally to opt out of it, still take your money and go private, or do you have to pool everybody's money to pay for the program? But I assume that's the kind of stuff that, wherever Doug is, it would be brought up in the study as well. It's, you know, people got to think about that. But I've just heard enough stories of people I thought were going to be, I thought they were going to have a bigger, you know, less of a cost by the time this is all said and done, and they're just not yet, anyway. So, that's why I'm interested in it, personally.
Well, I'm interested.
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Representative Thompson.
Representative Thompson.
I appreciate what Representative Conger just said. I'm going to support this because I think we are at a juncture in healthcare where we don't know exactly what the right answer is. And if we can learn something from this study bill and the Washington experience that will help us put another piece of the puzzle together, I think it's worth the effort. And this is not something that we're funding internally, so it's a community type situation. And I think it would be interesting to see. Question of whether or not people are going to willingly go down this road is already one that we're wrestling with. I'm finding an increasing number of people, as I talk to constituents, who are opting out of the Affordable Care Act. They don't want any subsidy. They don't want any government insurance. They want to be left alone. And there are people that clearly qualify for huge subsidies, all kinds of things, but they don't want to mess with it. And I think the idea that we'll have universal insurance is probably a little utopian considering where people's mindsets are. And some of these people are people with children that I think would jump for the chance to get heavily subsidized insurance, and they're not. And so maybe there's another position in here we need to be working with when we find more information by looking at this kind of a study.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would just piggyback on that a little bit. You know, I think we all had hoped that the Cover Oregon numbers would be up from where they are.
Yeah.
I think this is another chance to take a stab at why is that population not signing up. It may have to do with the rollout and all the problems that have come with that, but it may have to do with other things. I think it's a relatively small amount of money. I guess I would, it says OHA would commission a study. I guess I would encourage that to be an independent study. I think that would just be more helpful for it to be an independent as opposed to an in-house. So I'll just put that on the record as, you know, my personal plea.
$55,000 estimates from Urban Institute for a study that would add a local piece to the national piece that they've been working on. We're talking about something a couple of years off, but I really would like to have lots of options. I think the more options we have, in some ways, the better off we are. I fear that the basic health plan would destabilize the exchange, and that's the question that I told them really needs to be. If you take this money out of the exchange's subsidies and put it to a special population, that may affect the financial viability of the exchange, and I wouldn't like to see that happen. So that's an important question that we need to be raising here. But I think, I'm a researcher, I think information is useful, in spite of the fact that we don't always use information around here to make decisions.
What?
Will you call the roll, please?
Representative Klim?
Aye.
Representative Conger?
No.
Representative Parker?
Aye.
Representative Kinnemer?
Aye.
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Excuse.
Vice Chair Kenny Geyer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Thompson?
Aye.
And Chair Greenlee?
Aye. The motion carries. The bill's off to Ways and Means for its tender mercies. We have finished the agenda today.
Yes, we have.
This would be five bills today. A good start. I think we're going to have a big bill on Wednesday.
Farm Bureau cake.
Which one?
You probably get
bill
so
on
much
the exchange.
On the campaign.
Yeah. That's going to take a lot of discussion. So we'll only have four bills or maybe three on Wednesday, but we should have a fair amount of discussion on one of the bills we have. That's right. We should have
one of each.
That's a DME bill on Wednesday as well. Thank you. No?
Probably not.
We won't have it on Wednesday?
I doubt if we'll have the combined amendment and the fiscal and the revenue back.
Really?
We're not the only committee.
Yeah, I've heard. They feel the pressure.
But we'll try.
No.
Well,
as soon as we get
Are you carrying 4108 over?
Yeah, let's carry 4108 over just in case.
For the work session. All right.
For our work session on Wednesday if we get the paperwork. Anything else we're carrying over?
No, that, everything else. That when we moved, that we adopted the amendments. 4085, I was going to put up on Friday.
Just that's the
that's the colonoscopy because we don't have the fiscal for that.
Okay.
So that has a work session, and then 4050, the Doug Barber bill that we just heard.
Put that up on Friday as well.
Okay.
Put that up on Monday.
Monday?
Yeah. We'll have a chance to talk about it.
Great.
Some work on it, so we all know what we're talking about here.
All
right. Representative Harker, will you continue to work on the reinsurance bill? So
I am as we speak.
Good. We're adjourned.
And so.